Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being here after Hillary. I know it's a tough act to follow, but hopefully we will keep you extremely entertained because we have an amazing panel here. So my name is Mandu Sen, and I'm a program manager here at our Regional Plan Association. And before we dive into our panel discussion, I want to give you some background on how the fourth regional plan addresses planning reform, and then zoom into New York City, sort of to give you the story of why we're here today and you know why we're having this panel. So the fourth regional plan, of course, we talked about it all morning, is metropolitan in scale. So big infrastructure, broad policies. But ultimately, its implementation depends on the 782 cities, towns, and villages, New York City being just one of them, that compose the region. And as we worked on the plan and talked to people, from community groups to developers to mayors, we heard the same thing. The process of planning, whether comprehensive plans or individual project approvals, was broken. The real estate community, expanding businesses, saw uncertain timelines as large obstacles for development. Leaders in smaller municipalities or, you know, community boards didn't have anywhere near the capacity to do an effective planning process. There was, of course, a lot of variability in the region. People in New York City pointed to other cities with master plans as good examples to follow, while many outside of New York City thought that ULURP's clear timelines were a really good model. And another theme that came up again and again, many low-income communities and communities of color felt that they had little say in what shaped their neighborhoods. In the fourth plan itself, we tried to do better on community engagement. The plan's policies were deeply influenced by the partnership we forged with community organizations from all over the region. Make the Road New York, Community Voices Heard, among others. They informed our existing conditions, influenced our potential solutions, and are continuing to work with us on implementation. Our work together also shaped our conviction that investing in civic engagement should be core to RPA's proposed governance reforms. So this is why, in addition to recommendations on a regional coastal commission or reducing the cost of capital construction, you know, classical RPA sort of topics, we made recommendations for planning reform in the region. And the following are its broad principles. All cities, towns, and villages should have up-to-date comprehensive plans. All projects should have a fixed timeline for community input and government approvals. We need to reform the environmental review process so that it's linked to comprehensive plans, examines positive as well as negative impacts, and includes health. And we need to invest in community engagement and diversify planning boards and community boards. Shifting to New York City, planning activity has been focused on the 15 neighborhood rezonings, mostly taking place in low-income communities of color. While there are good reasons to invest in and develop these neighborhoods, many are concerned that this growth would be far from inclusive. Furthermore, many other neighborhoods that could support transit-oriented development were not included in the rezonings. As just one example, this map shows where there may be a business case to develop, redevelop parcels into 4 to 5 story multifamily buildings. That's the gray areas, the darker gray areas. As you can see, there's very little overlap between that and where the rezonings have been taking place, which is the purple. In response to rezonings, the Office of Borough President Gail Brewer, Councilman Antonio Reynoso, RPA, as well as dozens of community groups, founded a working group focused on land use reform. They put their time and energy to produce recommendations for a comprehensive citywide planning framework, just that, published in as Inclusive City, and you can find it on our website as well as clearly right here. And just a few weeks ago, the City Council voted to convene a Charter Revision Commission with a broad mandate. This is in addition to the Mayor's Commission, which we expect to focus on campaign finance reform. So, having set the stage, I'd like to introduce Mr. Corby, partner and chair of the Land Use and Zoning Group of Herrick Feinstein. He's an urban planner and land use attorney. And prior to joining Herrick Feinstein, Mitch served as commissioner for the New York City Board of Standards and Appeals. Before that, he directed the Department of City Planning's Brooklyn office and served as the deputy director of the Staten Island office. We're also really, really lucky to have him here on RPA's board and an advocate for having this conversation in multiple forums. So he'll be sharing his wisdom with us and being the moderator of today's discussion. And just a small housekeeping note. I know that some of you took questions via phone. We're going to be going old school and taking questions in person at the end. So no phone questions, just
low-tech contact.
That's it. Thank you very much.
Sorry, low-tech. Okay. Thank you so much for that introduction. Thank you. When I hear introductions like that, I'm reminded that I actually spent some time on Staten Island many, many years ago. thank you so much. So my name is Mitch Corby. I'm a zoning and land use lawyer, and I often like to warm things up, as my fellow panelists, many of you know, I like to warm things up by telling a zoning joke or two. As I've said before, the problem with that approach is there are no zoning jokes. I mean, there's the one about, well, you know, the zoning resolution being so complicated and long and big and complex that it now violates the zoning resolution. As I said, there are no zoning jokes. So let's move on.
Come on, Mitch.
If you get three zoning attorneys in a room, what do you get?
A very dull afternoon.
Exactly.
there is a zoning joke. So let's dive in. As was mentioned, you know, we're at an interesting and a fascinating and important time in New York where there's a lot of energy in the council and at the public advocate's office to do some good and new things. At the same time, New York City, of course, is at its population peak. Been a lot of successes over the past several years. Brooklyn is about to pass Chicago in terms of its population. This growth and development and change, generally speaking, has been a good thing, right? Our poverty rate is low in New York. The unemployment rate is remarkably low in New York. Our crime rate is low in New York. Good things have been happening across the city. Positive things, important things. Things that have made our city a leader. Things that have made our city twice the size of Los Angeles, I'm a proud New Yorker, right? Twice the size of Los Angeles, a resilient and important, energized place to be and to work and to live. We have a lot of challenges, though. Some of the things that lie ahead are ways to address empowering communities. How can we strengthen what we do here in New York to make sure that everyone's included in this progress? How can we address some of the affordable housing issues that we have in front of us? How can we make sure that our neighborhoods feel involved as we move forward and continue to grow our city? So with that as a backdrop, I think I'd like the panelists to briefly introduce themselves and describe briefly what's up with regard to this idea of improving things. What do we need to do? I mean, why is there something that's broken in light of the successes I just mentioned? And how can we fix this? And tell us a little bit about this charter reform initiative and how your role is shaping that, and then we'll come back and maybe ask a couple of provocative questions after that. So, public advocate Letitia James.
Thank you.
We'll start with you.
So first, good afternoon, everyone, and I want to recognize my fellow panelists, of course, my friend and former colleague, Council Manhattan Borough President Gail Brewer, Council Member Antonio Reynoso, Mayo Hudson, as well as Mitchell and Robert Schiffer. And I'm here today with the belief that the way our city looks at land use and planning is not efficient and inclusive as it should be. You mentioned Brooklyn, and I too come from Brooklyn.
Really? This is an ongoing joke.
Yes, ongoing joke, yeah. Which is much more populous than Manhattan. Thank you very much. Although there has been great population growth, as you mentioned, we have our challenges. And there's been a lot of displacement. And there are a number of concerns in and around Brooklyn and in and around those neighborhoods that have been rezoned. As you know, I was the city council member who represented downtown Brooklyn when we did our first rezoning. And as you know, in downtown Brooklyn, we have transformed the landscape in downtown Brooklyn. But as a result of changing the landscape and as a result of that rezoning, which was originally intended to be a commercial rezoning, it unfortunately produced nothing but luxury housing. And in fact, what we are now experiencing in the borough of Brooklyn is gentrification on steroids. And so rent is definitely too damn high, and residents are doubled up and tripled up all throughout the borough of Brooklyn. And so what we've got to do is begin to look at how we begin to plan. And it's important that everyone know that when you look at rezonings, and the answer has always been rezonings, but rezoning is not planning. Rezonings are not planning. And there's never been a comprehensive approach and look at how we plan in the city of New York. And as a result, the city risks being unable to adapt to the challenges ahead. and including the growing population, the increasing demand for affordable housing, supportive housing, for a wide range of constituencies, and how we respond to climate change. And right now, one of the best tools that we have at our disposal is the upcoming review of our city charter, or our governing document, or our constitution in the city of New York. And we haven't examined our charter, our constitution, in over 30 years. And so that is why my friend, Manhattan Borough President Gail Brewer, and I have introduced legislation, which is why we're here today, which speaks about a commission to look into this charter. New York is a diverse and ever-changing, yet the charter has not been touched in over 30 years. And it's this charter that dictates so much of what we do, from land use decisions, to budget allocations, to affordable housing, to control and jurisdiction, to checks and balances, and the rules that all of us must abide by. And the commission that we are now putting together will take a deep look at all of these issues with the goal of effectively addressing the needs of neighborhoods and communities across the city. Now, I've heard from some developers in the city of New York who are concerned about this commission, who are concerned that this is nothing more than an effort to slow down development in the city of New York and to increase the voice of communities and to oppose much needed development in the city. And I say that's not my purpose. My purpose, obviously, is to, again, look at our constitution and to look at the charter and to examine all of these issues which have not been examined, because all the charter commissions in the past have been one-offs. They've been primarily looked at through the eyes or the lens of a mayor who was particularly focused on one particular issue. And I think Gail and I want to look at a more comprehensive, a holistic approach to the charter in the city of New York, and to look at and establish the rules of the game with regards to land use and decision making in a fair and equitable and transparent manner. And it's a critical step towards ensuring that all communities and all stakeholders and New Yorkers feel included and valued in the decisions that impact them, because there have been concerns, again, all throughout the city, that land use decisions are often done behind closed doors, and when they're presented to the community, it's already a done deal, and their voices are excluded, and that communities can only, you know, touch the fringes of a plan which has already been baked. And so it's really critically important for me, because someone who believes that government really should be from the ground up and not the top down, and that we should hear from all voices, and all voices should be at the table. And so we must have a plan for change. We must hear from the community, both on the citywide and the neighborhood level. And New York, is one of the few large cities that does not really have a comprehensive plan to address the growth in our city and development going forward. So it's both a challenge and an opportunity. And I recognize, you know, as someone once said, a crisis really is an opportunity for progress. And so given this crisis in the city, given the crisis with regards to affordable housing, climate change, infrastructure, we can take this crisis and turn it into an opportunity. And I think the best step to do that is looking at our charter. I thank you.
Thank you so much. So Manhattan Borough President Brewer, as Public Advocate James just mentioned, our charter hasn't been changed since 1989. I, of course, remember 1989 because I'm the same age as the zoning resolution. But I keep trying. Yes, yes. So since it hasn't been changed in so long, and since it is our constitution, why do it now? It's such a dramatic thing to do. And maybe there are things that can be done well short of changing the charter, whether it's new legislation at the council or elsewhere. I know you have strong feelings about the charter, and also some issues about not in my backyard and what you're dealing with in Inwood.
Thank you.
What do you think?
Well, first, I have a joke that's better than everybody else.
You have a joke.
Yes. And it comes from Jimmy Otto, who's a borough president of Staten Island, whom I love. And it's a planning joke. So under the borough president, we're able to allocate names to streets, right? And so he has a developer who was horrible on all levels. And so the developer wanted to name the streets like Timber Street and things like that. So Jimmy suggested Cupidy Drive, which means inordinate desire for wealth. That would be one street. Another is Forbury Lane, defined as trickery and deception. That's another street. And Avidy Place derived from Avida, meaning greed. Those are the three names of the streets he gave in the development. And the developer went to court, and Jimmy Otto won. So people are moving into these streets. I love these stories. That's my favorite planning story. And he won. So in terms of planning and the figuring out with the charter, so the charter that Tish and I are working on is a two-year charter, meaning that we won't have any final decisions until 2019 and the November referendum at that time. So it gives us more time to plan. If you're going to have a charter, and the person who knows more about this than anybody else is the general counsel in our office, Jim Karras, who's here today. But the fact of the matter is we want a discussion about what you want, what, you know, we have ideas about planning and budget and figuring out who is the best decision maker for commissioners and so on and so forth. There are lots of issues to be discussed, and the last time I was around in 1989 also, and that was the last time the Public Advocates Office was created, CCRB. Big ideas, of course, the borough presidents got screwed, but I understand that. That's how it goes.
You can still name streets, though.
We can still name streets. Only Jimmy Otto has good ideas. So. Anyway, what I'm saying is we need everyone's ideas for the charter, and it will be a device group, very diverse group, and there will be lots of hearings, maybe 15 hearings. Three in different sessions in every single borough. That will take a lot of time and effort, and I think we'll be successful in terms of coming up ways to plan differently. But having just today or yesterday submitted the plan from our perspective for the inward rezoning, this is really hard work. When I first came into the borough presidency, I saw that some developer wanted to put a big tall building in the historic South Street Seaport. I said, hell no. And to the credit of the City of New York, in this case EDC, we sat down with a facilitator with all the stakeholders in the area, and there's no big, tall building in the South Street Seaport, and I don't think you'll ever see one. Mm-hmm. We're now working on the museum, and how is it a historic district based on the suggestions that came out of that discussion. That's called pre-planning, and that's what we want as part of the planning process for the City of New York, because if you get this, the scoping starts tomorrow, and then the City Planning Commission soon thereafter hits the gavel and you're started on the ULURP clock, it is very hard for community boards, borough presidents, even the City Council, to work on complicated ULURPs in a short period of time. Same thing with East Midtown. I want to thank former council member Dan Goronic and the city. All stakeholders sat down for the area around Grand Central. I think you'll see in Cranes or the Times this week, I think it was Cranes, and then in addition you saw that JP Morgan Chase is staying put. Give you an example, 10% of all the property taxes of the City of New York come from that area, from East Midtown. And the new building that had a big story in the Times this week, or Cranes, I can't remember, said A, they're selling their space, renting their space, and B, before that building was built, the buildings on the site paid $8 million in property taxes. In the new building, it's $52 million in property tax. So we need to have those kinds of redevelopments that make sense. In that case, every new building near a subway has to put money into the subway. They have to also look at allocation of air rights, landmarks, paying them, and public realm, public space. So it's a combination, it's a formula. You build, you got to pay for the infrastructure. And you have to make sure that people can walk down the street and have some public realm in order to walk down the street in. The same thing with the garment center. When the mayor said it's going to Brooklyn, I said, hell no. And to the credit of the city, we have a facilitator. Sorry. We're a facilitator. No, it wasn't going to Brooklyn. It hasn't gone to Brooklyn yet, if you notice. A facilitator is a preservation. Hell no. Preservation area. We need to have the center of the garment center be in Manhattan with spokes in other parts, but we have to figure out how we can reduce the rent through IDA. We have to buy a building. We have to work with the manufacturers. There are 800 manufacturers in the garment center right now. Yes, there are issues. They need to be addressed. Again, I'm giving the short version, but this is pre-planning. I think it'll end up some go to Brooklyn, some go to Long Island City. We don't want them to go to New Jersey. We don't want them to go to Long Island. We don't want them to go to London and Florence. We want them to stay in New York. You have to plan for that. You cannot do it any other way. East Harlem, I want to thank the former speaker, Melissa Marfavito. There was a plan by the neighborhood. They spent 2.5 years meeting almost every week. and they came up with a neighborhood plan with something like 262 recommendations. And then the city, through the process, our office and her office and others, and thanks to the city council, some almost 100, some 60 or 70 of those recommendations were allocated. And now the community is sitting down to plan not only for the agreements, but also for those who weren't, and see how they can make it make sense. Again, it's all about pre-planning. And I also want to just talk about the issue of, the other issue, preservation of housing and new housing comes into this. It's a very complicated formula. Nothing is easy. Same thing with the stores. How are you going to keep our mom and pops in our city? In Manhattan, this is a huge issue, and other boroughs increasingly so. So we don't have a solution. Do we have, as I did on the Upper West Side, smaller streetscapes, certain number of square footage and storefront in terms of that's what it should be, or are there rent issues? We're dealing with the online challenges. We don't have the data. How many vacant stores do we have in New York City? So we have a bill to try to get that information. So I'm giving you some challenges that we're trying to address. In this Inwood that we submitted yesterday, how do we preserve the most of rent-regulated housing in all of Manhattan? How do you deal with the preferential rents? How do you deal with the auto repair stores? How do you deal with the folks who are in the mom and pops in a very vibrant area? Do I have the answers? No. Do I know that pre-planning is a must, and you cannot hit that clock without enough time for the neighborhood and the developers and every one of these stakeholders, the developers, REVNY, the business community is always part of the discussion. To me, these are the hardest issues, and that's why this panel is so phenomenal, but these are the hard issues that we're trying to address.
Thank you very much. Councilmember, you began talking about pre-planning and pre-ULURP, I think, a couple of years ago, well in advance of this dialogue about charter reform. Frankly, many of my clients are developers, and what they crave most, of course, is predictability, to understand at the beginning what's expected of them as they approach the end, to know that the decisions aren't being made in the kind of closed rooms that used to be smoke-filled, that those kinds of decisions can sometimes be difficult and arbitrary. So can you talk a little bit about how your concept, which began some time ago, is connected to this charter change idea?
Yes. Okay. I want to start with just 2 points before I make I speak to your points. Okay. Is that I started this because of the Broadway Triangle and the segregation that exists in North Brooklyn, in which three communities, the Latino, Black, and Hasidic Jewish communities, are all separated by three blocks in Union, on Flushing, and on Broadway. I wanted to change that, and some people don't want to change that. They want to maintain segregation. It was actually rezoned, the Broadway Triangle, and we won it in court, though. We went and fought against the rezoning, saying that it perpetuated segregation and that it was discriminatory. We actually won that, and the city had to go back to the drawing board and figure out how not to make that happen. They then recently had a property called the Pfizer property, which is the Pfizer used to be here in Brooklyn. They rezoned that area as well, and we said again that this is continuing to discriminate and it's not fair housing. We have an injunction that just came down a couple of months ago. So it seems like the only way we can get fair housing in the city of New York is to sue and take them to court. So I wanted to change that. I wanted another avenue that would allow for the city to do this, a study, a work, to make sure that fair housing is happening and the discrimination doesn't happen before we have to vote on it in the city council. But there's something also called a council member, what do you call it? We can't tell the council members no from their district that they can't do something. So
local preference, huh? Local deference.
Deference. Local there you deference. Go, council member deference. What it happens is that if a council member wants to build a 100-story building, and it be completely discriminatory, it could do whatever. They can do it. We don't stop them from doing it because we don't want to interfere in other people's districts. But in some cases, especially when it comes to like racial discrimination, I just can't stand idly by while that's happening in the district. So I feel like I want to be able to say something, and I think that this is going to allow us that opportunity. Now, in response to your question, you mentioned predictability. SL Green needs some predictability, right? And how we do that is we have two projects, one in Idanis' district, which is related to the Inwood site, and another one is in Councilmember Jimmy Van Bramer's district, that two projects that got shut down at the last minute in the city council because of what they considered non-clear pre-planning that happened, right? They found out that one of these buildings had huge issues of one of these developers had huge issues with maintenance of a building across the street in Jimmy Van Bramer's district. So Jimmy Van Bramer said, the council member said, I'm not going to allow you to develop until you don't fix the problems of the building across the street. This we could have all found out a year ago if we would have had a pre-planning process. So that developer had to wait a whole year to fix the problem, to start the clock all over again through a EULR process. That is not predictability. That is extending the time. A pre-application process that could be three, two, or one month longer can actually help with understanding a lot of these issues before they become a problem later on in the process. So I actually think it would help. And I'm also doing this because I had a land use chair that told me that, Antonio, you would never change this. Why even try? And then this charter commission stuff comes up, and I'm like, oh, there it goes. So I'm looking forward to when this is over that we do change it, and I can look at that former chairman of land use and let them know that that we can do things here in the city of New York that are meaningful for people, especially when it comes to discrimination. Thank you very much.
Somebody from Brooklyn.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Antonio. I appreciate that. Rob, you're the managing director of the SL Green, which is the city's largest landlord, I believe, and you've been intimately involved in a recent ULIP application that was successful. That was the outgrowth of the East Midtown rezoning, I guess phase one, the borough president worked on with then Councilmember Gorodnick. So you have a lot of experience and a lot of recent experience with the trials and tribulations of the uniform land use review process. Maybe speak a little bit about that from your perspective, and how are you feeling about this dialogue so far this afternoon? not to put you on the spot.
A number of different questions there. First of all, we can talk a little bit about One Vanderbilt and the One Vanderbilt corridor, the Vanderbilt corridor rezoning in Greater East Midtown. We were lucky in many regards because we had great vision from both the council member, Dan Baronick, and the borough president, Gail Brewer, as well as the administration, which built upon many of the failings under the Greater East Midtown version 1 that then Mayor Bloomberg had proposed, and took those failings, turned them around into solutions, and built those solutions into a credible zoning framework that ultimately had a successful ULURP experience. Mm-hmm. It was a pretty simple problem that we dealt with. Aging building stock resulted in a number of major corporations moving from Greater East Midtown over to the West Side. We needed to reverse that flow, and in order to reverse that flow, we needed to build new buildings. But the community was right in that we needed new transportation, more efficient transportation, before those new buildings were built and the added density added to the neighborhood. So it's a pretty simple formula, but even with that simple formula, I wrote down some dates here because I think this is important. Mayor Bloomberg proposed the first Greater East Midtown in 2012. It was ultimately withdrawn at the end of 2013. In 2014, Mayor de Blasio proposed Vanderbilt Quarter. That didn't pass until May 15. It's now May 17. We're a third of the way through construction, and we won't TCO until 2020. That's a total of 8 years to get from initial planning to completion of a project. When you look at the cost of capital that it takes for real estate development in New York City, with, you know, mortgage rates for speculative land development in the high single digits, equity rates in 15-20%, weighted average cost of capital between 10-12%. If you compound that cost of capital over that same 8-year period, you need to double your cost just to break even. It's a challenge in terms of the duration of the process. We at SL Green are highly supportive that there needs to be an agency for comprehensive planning. We do agree with that. That was evident in Greater East Midtown, and it has worked remarkably well. We think that J.P. Morgan's announcement is a huge boon, and a great statement to be made for all the leadership that went into the Greater East Midtown rezoning. Community planning, comprehensive planning needs to result in frameworks where developers can develop as of right. And I think that's one nuance that gets lost in a lot of this conversation. At the end of a comprehensive plan, we strongly believe that there needs to be as-of-right frameworks so that developers have clarity, so that there's a finite process for which development can occur.
Thank you very much. Malo, we don't have a comprehensive plan in New York City. we are lacking, as I think the public advocate mentioned, we're lacking a master plan.
Yes.
So here we are, once again, twice the size of Los Angeles, and we don't have a plan that guides us. Yeah. In light of what Rob just said and what others have said, maybe I know you're a professor at Columbia University in the planning program, so maybe you could talk
to us. So great. So I have, for full disclosure, I just moved here 8 months ago. And I have a New York story for you since it's Friday. I'll tell you the story. So my family and I arrived here in August, end of August, and my son's on my lap in the subway car, and I say, don't touch anything. So halfway between one stop to the next, he's licking. I see the lady across from me. Her eyes go like this, and I'm like, what's going on? I look at him. He's licking the pole. So all the New Yorkers on the car voted unanimously that was the worst father ever. My wife didn't talk to me for a couple days. But when we got off the car, I said, what's wrong with you? I said, don't touch anything. And he goes, I didn't. I licked it. So I told my wife, that's definitely your side of the family.
How's he feeling? Is he feeling
so,
okay?
So there is an upside. There's an upside to this. He has the best immune system than anyone in his kindergarten class. He didn't get sick at all this year. So that's my New York story. But in all seriousness, my work is around community development and health equity. I do work domestically and internationally. And I would say the problems that you're facing in New York are just like everywhere else with a strong economy, whether it be San Francisco, London, Santiago, places I've worked. And the real issue, and I want to go back to what public advocate James said, the real issue for communities is they see tremendous amount of investment happening, tremendous amount of money, global capital from all over the world coming into these cities. And what they feel like is they don't have control over their own lives.
That's right?
They see new buildings coming up, investment here. They're working 2 and 3 jobs, and they're trying to make it. And so the real issue isn't what control do I have? Where are the ways to interact with the system, so to speak? Or where are the roles of our civic institutions in understanding our opinions? You heard earlier the chairman of RPA saying, looking at the issue of NYCHA, right? Just residents not feeling like they have a voice. So this is typical in many communities. And I think what they would like to see is these early planning efforts to say, what is the broader vision? Where it be around equity, prosperity, job growth, housing? Where can they interact and add value? And so that's what I found over and over. One of the big issues is trust. So not a lot of trust there. So let me get to, I don't want to be negative because that's what professors do. We just complain and talk about the problem. But I would say coming from California, so I was at Berkeley prior to this, did a lot of work in San Francisco. My most recent book is on San Francisco, New York, Boston, and Washington, D.C., looking at some of these issues around neighborhood change, displacement. And I would say that coming to New York, one thing that you have that many places do not have is you have institutions. You have cultural institutions. You have a tremendous amount of capital here, whether it be people like Rob and others. I mean, there's capital here, right? And you actually have dialogue. And I know that you're all very critical, but I would say coming here, I have to say that you actually get in each other's faces. It's not always pretty, but you have dialogue. Mm-hmm. Where in California, we could be very passive-aggressive. Mm-hmm. I want to get into all that. But what communities are asking for is this. What role does culture and history play in a community? Right, so there's discussion around culture in institutions and saying, how do we incorporate those things into a 21st century planning model, a comprehensive plan? And you may not have a comprehensive plan, but I'll tell you, even cities with comprehensive plans, it doesn't matter if you don't have the political will, you don't have the investment on the ground for community organizations to have the capacity to bring people to the table. I mean, we can, if you look at social media, so we heard former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton talk about social media and so forth, and we have technology, and yet we still do the same model of planning, right? We have the meeting, people need to show up, but we could focus better on our translational services, we could focus on how people can get input into the city. So we could think outside the box in ways, how do you incorporate a city like New York or a metropolitan region like New York that's diverse and has many, and I mean diversity in all kinds of ways, right? You all know this better than I do, you've been here forever. But incorporate them in the process. And so whether it be going to Santiago, Chile, where they feel like things are centralized to a point where if you're outside the major city, you have no voice. So what are the ways that we can connect with each other? So I just want to mention a few things, and I'll be quiet as the outsider. But one is thinking of ways to have partnerships. So in the Bay Area, there's the Richmond Health Equity Partnership, which the city, to its credit, said we need to look at the issues around homicide, environmental injustice, asthma, you know, differences in life expectancy by race and ethnicity, class, and so forth, and said let's bring people to the table from the city, the county, the school district, as well as nonprofit leaders to have a conversation of what does it look like to have a prosperous region, for an equitable region, a healthy city, and so forth. What does that look like? Mm. So they've now done health in all policies through their comprehensive plans. I talked to Eric Shaw yesterday, the director of planning in Washington, D.C. He said they're concerned about the same issues. They now are focusing on a cultural plan, which is, again, taking just the economics off the table, not saying it doesn't matter, but saying, how do we incorporate culture into this? So artists and people who are at the table, other young people, getting them involved in the process. So there are some things there. What you end up having, if you don't do that, is resistance. And so in San Francisco, there are groups that just say, okay, no to everything. If we're not going to get our piece, we're going to blow everything up. That means no to any new development. Right. That means no to, and that doesn't really benefit anyone, because then you run into issues of not enough housing being built. You run into the financial problems that Rob just talked about from an investor side. You're thinking, I don't want to do business there. And so I think that we have to think about those things.
This is not my backyard issue. And yes. Land use paralysis is a big issue, and that can be the result. Public advocate, you wanted to jump in.
So let me just push back. Yeah. It's not a question of NIMBYism all the time. It's a question of not being inclusive and not being at the table. Mm-hmm. And that's really the issue. Mm-hmm. And it's this sense that my voice is not being heard and that decisions are being made from my backyard without my voice. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you speak about culture. Like, for instance, when they plan in downtown Brooklyn, the cultural district, most of the cultural organizations that were local community-based cultural organizations weren't at the table. That was a plan drafted by developers. Same thing for, and you all know my story, Atlantic Yards, which is now Pacific something. And then they sold it, as you know, what I'm struggling here is, and the issue is before all of us, whether or not you support this charter revision or not, the issue is that we continue to do planning by one-offs. Yep. The borough president of Manhattan mentioned the neighborhoods, Inwood, Manhattan, Central Manhattan, and whatever, as opposed to this comprehensive approach. Listen, Seattle has a robust neighborhood planning program. Los Angeles has drafted a comprehensive citywide plan. New Jersey has introduced the idea of cross-acceptance, where city-level plans have to reflect the wider goals of the statewide plans. I am not anti-development, and please don't walk away with this notion. The issue is balancing development, particularly at a time when we've got a crisis in affordable housing, supportive housing, et cetera, at the same time as recognizing the fact that the community voices would like to be heard. I would like to refer to it as responsible development. I support responsible development, where all voices are heard, and it's transit-oriented, and we address all of the issues that we discuss. And it includes infrastructure, it includes schools, it includes public assets, it includes culture, all of those things and more. In downtown Brooklyn, you know, they've never planned for this growth in children, and so the schools are not sufficient to address the demand for education. The parks are insufficient, the infrastructure is insufficient, and the list goes on and on and on. And now there's a huge controversy in downtown Brooklyn, I'm sure you heard it, in response to 80 Flatbush Avenue, an 80-story building, and the neighborhood is going bananas. Mm-hmm.
And so can I just, of course, just yeah. and try That's to be right. quick, because I think Rob said a good thing. If there is a comprehensive plan that is put forth by the city of New York, that everybody kind of has to abide by that, everybody got to shut up and go home, and they let them build according to that plan, right? And I think that we would be open to that, right? I think that the communities, what they have, is that this spot zoning, right, which is what's happening. We're going to different places. Like my community in Bushwick is going through rezoning, but they don't feel that the Upper West Side is doing their part for affordable housing. They don't feel that Chelsea is doing their part for affordable housing. They don't feel like Park Slope is. So everyone is saying, right. why is there all these neighborhoods of color that are extremely poor, that have a lot of disinvestment over That's years, right. have to bear the burden of building all the affordable housing in the city of New York? Now, if my community felt that all these other white affluent districts are going to do their part, then maybe they would want to do their part. And they see that they're part of this bigger picture. But we don't have that. What we have is these, again, coming into these communities, telling them that we're going to introduce new housing while they're already being gentrified and being phased out. It's not like this is going to start gentrification. They believe it's going to speed gentrification up. So again, I really think that this comprehensive plan can really start moving us in a better direction. But I would say that what we have now in DCP is wholly insufficient. Those folks are, it's, you know, the Columbia University, the planning folks, those students should not want to go to DCP to it being like their great location of where every planner wants to go. That's where plans go to die. There's no creativity. There's no creativity, no boldness. Like, I think that the project on One Vanderbilt was a great project. If you look at it, it was actually a really good project. It's something that the city council can be proud that we completed, but it could have been part of a comprehensive plan, and they don't need to come back every single time to go through another One Vanderbilt. If it worked there and it's within the same model and structure across the street, go ahead. Do the same thing. We know the investments are going to come to transportation. We know investments are going to come, that you're going to be able to be taller, have new buildings, attract new folks. So that's, I think it's all about who's contributing as well. The NIMBYism comes from the fact that it's poor communities right now that are building all the affordable housing, and we got to change that.
Rob, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think one of my fellow panel members here mentioned the word trust before, and that is certainly a major issue. We tried to turn that on its head when we went through our ULURP. One of the first roadblocks that we came to right after certification was, well, you guys are spending $220 million for transit improvements. Mm-hmm. You made that deal in a back room with the MTA. We, the community, have no idea how you came up with 220. We don't know if that's a real number. We don't know if that's a fake number. And so what we did was, rather than do what other developers do and maybe just let the ULURP clock run its course and not answer that question, we actually held a meeting in our offices. We brought the Tri-Borough Task Force in, about 30 members of the community. We went through an hour and a half presentation where we took each element of the scope of the transit improvements that we're doing and put up a budget on a screen and showed them, here are the hard costs, here are the soft costs, here's the duration, here's the challenges, and this is why it costs what it costs. I think that, you know, in doing so, we were able to build trust with the community and ultimately had a successful year.
I want to say that certainly SL Green is a real positive player in New York, and it helped that it was a commercial district, because when you're in the residential, you know, I've done this now for 12 years on the council and certainly as borough president, it's much different in an older residential district. In the downtown, you know, the lower Manhattan has gone from 20,000 residents to 60 or 70,000 residents. Mm-hmm. So they're used to the taller buildings. Of course, there's no planning. You don't have enough school seats, et cetera, open space, but you don't have that fervent challenge in terms of my neighborhood, because I grew up there and it's been five generations. I want to just talk about data for a minute, because one of the things that, you know, I'm a real data maven, pass the open data bill. We're working on vacant storefronts. We train the community board members. I don't want to leave out community boards, because they really do play a major role in local planning. And every borough is different, but in Manhattan, we are training every board member on data. We're training them on parliamentary procedure and land use and budgeting and some of the things that in the plan that RPA produced you think should be part of the planning process. So as we talk about master plan, if that should help in our, you know, maybe during the budget, I mean, the Charter Revision Commission, we can call for that. You know, that could be something that we call for. However, in the interim, we need to talk about this data challenge, which is not the community residents, in order to plan, have got to have the same data that the academics do or that the city planning, because they don't have it. So you walk into a room like this with a full group of participants, and there's no data to be able to show what is or isn't in that neighborhood, and we've got to change that. The second thing I want to mention is, you know, the Hillary Clinton talked about resiliency and so on. One of the challenges we have is we know there should be more opportunity to go from New Jersey and New York. We know there should be resiliency, but I would love to have the storm surge barrier under the Verrazano Bridge, which costs a lot of money, but it's much better than having a wall go around our neighborhoods, which is another possibility if we don't want to spend the big money to do the transportation, to make the bus station and the tunnel, and to figure out how to do the real infrastructure. So these poor neighborhoods are stuck planning for things that are relevant to them perhaps, but they're not part of the big picture. And it's very frustrating to know that, you know, you are planning for something that really doesn't make sense because there's no other alternative because nobody will do what Hillary Clinton suggested earlier, was look at the big picture. And I love her, but it's good that she can talk about this, but she doesn't have to vote on this goddamn inward stuff. Just
FYI. can we keep with the organic portion of it? Because so
absolutely.
The borough president.
Local council member. Oh, you, this is not your district, though, council member.
You are right. I had to pay $24 for parking.
It's another issue.
Which is a good thing. Which is a good thing. The borough president talked about community boards. In Manhattan, she's doing it right. She's investing. But that's not in every single borough, especially in Brooklyn, where community boards end up being locations where you put in like political cast-offs that can't get real jobs in the city, and you can't hook them up with a job. Yes, and that's the reality. But in my district, for example, even though it is 38% Latino and Black, they represent less than 20% of the community board. And the Hasidim in my community, in Community Board 1, represent only about 14% of the community and have 28 to 30% of the seats in the Community Board. So they get to make the decisions as to whether or not that property that ultimately discriminated against Latinos and Blacks, whether or not it happens, and they're a part of that. So until we don't have also community board reform, we have to be very careful about giving them too much power or too much say-so because it's not reflective of the actual community. And it's this institutional messed upness is what I'm going to call it, from top to bottom in regards to how we're doing planning in the city of New York. And that's why this charter revision is a welcome idea. So we could start finally addressing all the issues from the developer side, from institutionally, from government sides, and also academics, whatever it is. But it needs to all be looked at again because it's not working.
In Manhattan, just so you know, we look at the demographics, we chart them, and then we try to make sure the community board represents them. We actually have charts, and we show them, and we pick people based on the demographics.
Maybe how a board member's appointed. Maybe you can explain how a board... I know.
So the board members in Brooklyn are appointed. 50% of the board members are 51 board members per community board. 50% of those are appointed by the borough president, and then depending on how much of the community board resides in your council district, you get a certain percentage of the last of the remaining 50%. So I get about 22% of the appointments, and then Councilmember Steve Levin, for example, gets about 28, and then the borough president gets the last 50%. If that math makes sense.
One of the challenges.
That's not how we do it.
Manhattan does it differently, yeah, exactly.
One of the challenges is the staff, though, because there's a very uneven staffing of community boards. And let's talk about that.
And that's really what we should be focusing on. Community boards obviously need to be strengthened, and what they need are full-time planners. What they need are professionals. Yeah. So, I don't want to speak to the politics of it. I want to speak to the professionalism which is needed at community boards.
Yeah.
And so we really need to professionalize our community boards so that they can engage in better planning.
Yes.
In addition to that, when you talk about pre-certification, it's really critically important that I don't want to take away this notion of pre-certification. I know there's a lot of discussion within the development community about how this Charter Revision Commission is nothing more than an attempt to remove this pre-certification. What I want to do is that information that is shared with developers who obviously have a very strong bargaining chip, that should be shared with the community. And then this way, again, you would have a level playing field for all individuals.
Yeah.
And then last but not least, this whole notion of deferring to council members is an issue that we should focus on.
Yes.
So this charter revision obviously wants to look not just at land use. We're focusing obviously because the subject matter here today is land use and city, and for me, planning. We need to look at a number of issues from A to Z with respect to our charter. And last but not least, including but that checks and balances on the administration. And also let me include the ability for the city council as well as the public advocate to have standing in court. It's really critically important that we have the capacity to initiate litigation, to provide checks and balances on the mayoralty, which obviously is stronger than all other city agencies.
And the other topic would be the budget, because as you notice today, there's a lot increase in the budget, but you often see, we call it units of appropriation, but all that means it says other $10 million. You have no idea what is in that, and that needs to be broken up. It was something that came up in 1989, but has not been realized. So the whole budget issue of what is in it, and how the community can have that information, as well as even the city council.
Mitchell wants to get a word in.
No, I want to, no, I want to get Milo's perspective because as a new New Yorker, I like what you said a moment ago about how we're in each other's face and we communicate. And this, by the way, is a wonderful dialogue and a very diverse panel, which I think is great. It's not always that. I think you wanted to jump in. I'm sorry. Well, yeah, Tony, you guys
are good. No, somewhat diverse. We only got one. We only got us all green, but we got your back, man. We're gonna take it as you.
I would say that I would agree with the professionalization of the community boards. They should have designated planners. Yeah. They should have access to data. So the data thing drives me crazy because there's no reason why data can't be much more transparent for cities, agencies, and so forth with community members because that data does make a big difference. And it gets back to the issue I brought up earlier around trust. When people don't feel like they have access to the data, they show up to a meeting like this, it's all packed, and then suddenly the data comes out and people, well, how can you react to that? So I think many of the suggestions are sound ones. Just looking at what's happening in San Francisco, that's, I had to come to New York where New Yorkers were telling me they don't want to be like San Francisco because of they call it the Manhattanization and many other cities, of other places. So the real issue there is how do you engage... How do you engage? I get the jokes now that you see. I learned a lot.
We've been having them for 20 years.
Yes. But in all seriousness, it is about engaging on a deep level because what you have in the case of the Mission District in San Francisco, the predominantly Latino community, Latinx community, is that they're saying if you don't, they first fought for a cultural district, so it's a Latino cultural district. And if you're not in line with it, they're saying no to pretty much any market rate development that doesn't have enough affordable housing. And so that's hurting everyone. And it's near transit. And so it's at the time we're talking about climate change and reducing our greenhouse gas emissions and all these things. We need to build around transit, but it has to be in a way that's in line with what local residents want and so forth. So as an outsider and now an 8-month-old New Yorker, I would say that I like what I hear.
So, and my last issue, and this is what I hear all throughout the city of New York, and I do represent all five boroughs, and I do love Manhattanites, so don't, is the environmental review process is wholly inadequate. We need an honest broker. And I heard someone applause back there. Thank you very much. So clearly going forward, we need an honest broker with respect to these environmental review studies. They're just not authentic, they're inadequate, and they don't represent the needs of communities. And it's really difficult, I understand, like, why would you bite the hand that feeds you? I got that. But we need an independent and honest broker to really analyze the impact of all development in the city of New York.
Same thing with CEQA. I mean, there's a city version and there's a state version.
Right.
But, both are not adequate. You get some numbers that make absolutely no sense.
I hear you. The last time the environmental law was changed was in 1977. This is a state law that really needs to change to reflect new reality in the state CEQA and city CEQA model. I think we should have some questions from the audience because some folks are anxious. Why don't we start with this gentleman over? I think you had your hand up earlier.
Hi, I'm John Manning.
John, where are you from? Manhattan, I hope, because we know.
I grew up and I was born and raised in Peter Cooper Village. Okay. I've been living in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn.
Born in Manhattan,
but he left.
How can we help?
My grandfather was born in Williamsburg in 1885.
Williamsburg, Antonio.
To the core. Let's empower communities. Let's empower ordinary people. Let's revise the city charter. All these, instead of this, he who has the gold makes the rules fit. Mm-hmm. Former mayoral candidate Sal Albanese has been a big advocate of replacing lobbying and campaign finance with democracy vouchers. Say every registered voter has the option of donating $25 or $50 to the candidate of their choice. I think that would really open up the process. It would encourage voter turnout. When I was a child, it was normal for 60% voter turnout in awful, back in the 50s, and I was born in 1958. Voter turnout right now is pathetic. Right. When Dan Donovan was elected to Congress in a special election, only 10% voted. Mm-hmm. Who's going to represent South Brooklyn and Staten Island in the Congress of the United States? Only 10% could be bothered to go over to the church and vote. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Okay.
The lobbying and campaign finance system is just he who has the gold makes the rules. We have bundling of 49-50 donations to politicians. Democracy vouchers as a concept. Why don't you kick it around at the city council, have like an open hearing on it? Democracy vouchers replacing.
So the city of New York has probably the most elaborate campaign finance system in the entire country.
Yeah.
I was able to run against Vito Lopez, who ran the party machine in Brooklyn. And I did that by getting 780 donations from, you know, what I call Doña Conchitas from the street. So I just want to put in perspective that it isn't who has the money in city council politics. And also, you know, there are two people here that I think had less money than people they were going against and still won, right? So I just want to put that in perspective a bit. And also, we got to be very careful about giving this voucher system. In my district, there's only 16,000 people that came out to vote. If I was to listen only to the people that supported me instead of being a more inclusive and like open-minded council member, I take care of everyone, whether you voted for me or not. Those vouchers could make it so that small groups of people get a lot of attention. And that's what I'm trying to break out of and start trying to empower more people, and especially folks that don't get to vote, including immigrants and non-voters.
Can I just say this real quickly? I don't know enough about democracy vouchers, but what I do know about is the state of New York. And right now what we have in place are laws that suppress voters. We need same-day registration. We need early voting. We need technology. We need instant runoff, and the list goes on and on. And the New York State Legislature, particularly in the Senate, needs to get off their needs to move these bills and address, obviously, the suppression of voters in our state.
Yep.
The gentleman in the back, I'm sorry, with the glasses. Yes, thank you. You could probably just speak loudly without...
Roosevelt Island. Anybody? Yes. Roosevelt Island, that's Manhattan. People don't know that.
What is it?
Roosevelt Island.
Roosevelt
I'm looking for a shout-out for my pro-president.
Look at a map. Look at a map.
Well, I'm saying, people don't know it. Never mind.
I know
you know, but...
They keep telling the borough president to look at a map.
Question. I agree that NIMBYism is not just a problem in the poor neighborhoods. It's also a problem in the Upper West Side where I live now. But I think the bigger gap, and I was wondering if you could speak to this, is about the generational difference. Everyone I know, all of my peers who are starting families like I am, are thinking about leaving the city. We don't want to do it, but we're thinking about it because that's when the reality of New York City housing prices, and I'm not talking about affordable, I'm not talking about, you know, quote unquote affordable housing, but a housing that's affordable to me.
Right.
And so if you could talk about the community boards, you talk about having experts, but how about generational change? And also when it comes to NIMBYism, I think it's people in their 30s, whether it's in gentrifying neighborhoods or wealthy neighborhoods, that are looking for more market rate housing to be built. So if you could speak to that. Thank you.
So let me just say this. I think we've got a shrinking middle class in our city, and that that will present challenges to us. Right now, the model in New York City is unsustainable. You've got increasing numbers of individuals who are struggling with poverty and a middle class, which unfortunately is constrained. And so we've got stagnated wages, and we've got a crisis in not only affordable housing, supportive housing, but middle-income housing, and home ownership opportunities are just not there. And in New York City, there are no products for home ownership. There are no products at all. And so the question is, where can we build for more middle-income housing? And what we need is a better coordination with our state and with our local government, and more cooperation with our federal government. There was a time, believe it or not, the federal government cooperated with us on housing, but you've got this brain surgeon who's in charge of HUD, who obviously doesn't know much about housing. And so I agree with you. As someone who represented Fort Greene and Clinton Hill, Prospect Heights and Crown Heights, and a little bit of Bedford-Stuyvesant, that was a challenge. All of my young families are leaving, and they're going to Long Island. But now they're coming back because the commute is horrible. And so, you know, you're absolutely 100% right. We need to build for middle-income families, and we need to build for children. Every unit that I can think of, particularly in this new development, is...
Isn't that the market to take care of? That's really the question. That's got to be market rate. Right? So how do we encourage that?
Well, I just want to say Mitchell Lama was the best program ever, whether it was co-op or rental.
Yes.
Either one.
Roosevelt
Island. Exactly. Roosevelt Island and all up and down Columbus Avenue and so on and so forth. You know them well. Unfortunately, we had a program which they could buy out as soon as they paid off the mortgage. And the so I could go on and on about Mitchell-Lama.
Yes.
But we really need another Mitchell-Lama program.
Right.
That would solve, you've got the family-sized apartments, they're affordable, and the developer at that time had a return. That's what we need. And again, you know, somebody has to make a decision in this city that, yes, we obviously need tall buildings, and some of them should be pied-à-terres, but we got too many of those. And so that's what I would say. We've got to find, because that's, Mitchell-Lama's can be structured for any income.
Exactly.
And that's what made sense. And they, every single family in those Mitchell-Lama's was successful because it was affordable. They were the pillars of the community.
That's right.
And they went on to do whatever they needed to professionally, and their kids did well. And it was all diverse. Every single building.
Housing is good, and more housing is better.
Yeah.
Sandra, go ahead.
First of all, thank you all. I agree with everything that's being said. My name is Sandra Rothbard. By day, I'm an urban planner, and by night, I'm the secretary of the Land Use Committee for Brooklyn Community Board, too.
A moment of silence.
Yeah. So when I'm speaking on behalf of myself and not my board, as public advocate mentioned earlier, we are in the middle of a very controversial ULURP application. The deference by city council members is a huge issue. Myself and many members of my community believe that what's the point of having a community board?
Right.
What's the point of having some of these advisory groups if city council members going to vote on it and everyone's going to follow suit? So that's first and foremost a huge issue. I also wanted to shout out to the Center for Urban Pedagogy.
Yes.
Just came out with a ULURP program, and they are doing a free workshop starting today, this weekend.
Yes.
Go look online. I will also say a little shout out to city planning, because our land use committee recognized that we did not have the data that was necessary. Mm. The 2004 rezoning for downtown Brooklyn was supposed to be commercial office
space.
That's
right.
It has turned into residential, and we want to know why.
That's
so
right.
City planning started coming to every land use committee we had, and they started giving presentations for the data. And it's something that I recommend that other community boards do. But I also wanted to commend Manhattan Borough President Brewer, I'm wondering if you, with the public advocate, can sort of share some of the tools that you've been giving to your community boards to the other borough presidents, because we very much need to be working together, getting
you're out of your
spaces,
mind,
dialoguing, because we all need to benefit from that, because we are volunteers and we are working full time.
Well, I passed a law with the city council and the state stating the 16 and 17 year olds should be on community boards. We put them on, and some boards won't do it. I mean, some borough presidents. So that's a hard one.
So I think what we need to do is one, obviously I support Mitchell-Lama, and we need to build upon state land going forward. But two, I think what we need to do is expand upon the bill that the Manhattan Borough president has introduced and is now law with regards to 16 and 17 year olds, and expand that to include, obviously, professionalizing community boards in the city of New York. That's a piece of legislation that my office is currently looking at and reviewing and examining for the possibility of introduction.
Okay, a couple more questions. Yes, sir. What's your name?
So my name is Pablo. I'm a Queens native, so none of the above.
Queens.
Yeah, I have a bit of Ridgewood Queens. So I am a Queen. I'm a bi-borough council member.
Oh, there we go. But I now live in Morningside Heights. I go to Columbia Law School. And so, so hello. two quick questions. One, you mentioned professionalizing community board meetings.
Yeah.
I go to CB9 meetings. I think that would make a lot of sense, I think, from what I see. At the same time, you're talking about bringing in more marginalized communities who get left out of the process. How do you balance that, especially when being in a community board obviously takes disposable time, income, sometimes education, depending on what kind of policy issues you're confronting. So how do you sort of really get people to come to the meetings? And two, I was very encouraged to hear the elected officials talk about needing to balance out the affordable housing across the city in neighborhoods like Morningside Heights, the Upper West Side, the Upper East Side, neighborhoods that, for the city's own report, can cross-subsidize more deeply affordable housing more thoroughly than the neighborhoods that have been picked for rezoning under the Housing New York plan. Respectfully, my question to you is, when will you propose that the mayor do so, that the mayor try to, do MIH or something similar in these, our 8, 9, 10 neighborhoods, these neighborhoods that can sustain more more development, taller buildings that are already built for that.
So let me just say that when I was a city council member, I was the founder, along with Brad Lander and Melissa Mark-Viverito, in forming the Progressive Caucus of the City Council. We were responsible, obviously, for putting forth recommendations with regards to 421A, which ultimately became adopted. We put an end to poor doors. We put an end to residential segregation. All of those initiatives were put forth by a progressive caucus, which I was one of the founders. And I think clearly going forward, this commission that Gail and I are proposing, which has become law, will obviously begin to look at all of these issues. The three agencies that are responsible for planning in the city is city planning, land use, and landmarks. All of those have requirements. Why not community boards? Why is it open-ended? And I think we need to, again, in order to professionalize it, we need to put some sort of requirements, not maybe perhaps requirements, but also perhaps the possibility of considering individuals' backgrounds before they are appointed to a community board. I think it's really, really critically important. And this way you can avoid what Councilmember Reynoso had described earlier.
I would love to hear, because it's hard for us, you know, in Manhattan, we have a lot of as of right buildings. And so what happens is, even though I would, if the city in some way or shape or form, text amendment, zoning change, doesn't have any say about a building, that's one of the offers, you know, I guess because of the takings issue, you know better than I, we can't change that. But that's the problem. To me, every single building built in the city of New York should have some affordable housing, particularly because of our crisis. But we're not able to do that. And Morningside Heights is an example, unfortunately.
We have time for one or two more questions. Yes, ma'am.
I speak very loud, but I'll try.
We can hear you.
I'm going to keep the mic over here. Hi, everybody. My name is Santa Soriano. I work for Community Service Society.
You've got to tell us where you live, or this is not going to work.
Yeah. As you know, Mishra Lama is dear to CSS, our policy analyst on water, when the mayor actually said that he came up with his housing plan. We actually address them and say why we don't be more Mutual Ama, because the middle class can benefit from it, right? I can tell you what happened. Mm-hmm. So another issue, obviously, for CSS is NYSHA as well, and I was glad that the chairman actually addressed that it wasn't so much part of the regional plan. I mean, NYSHA live in a lot of this community. It sits in a lot of this community that are now Priceline, right? Yeah. So we have the Upper West Side, we have Chelsea, we have many of NYSHA buildings that are being affected, and basically those residents are being left without their
That's
community,
right.
Because now what's the supermarket their goal? What's the laundromat their goal? Basically, you know, we have somebody out there talking about putting a supermarket in NYSHA because they know that NYSHA now is left out with a lot of people. Personally, and I'm gonna say personally because I also try to always address some of my personal concerns. Recently, there was an article about how the middle class is not even taking advantage of the so-called affordable housing that is being built. Because you have an apartment that is two bedroom for $3,000. We know that a lot of the middle class in New York City basically went to college, have student loans, have kids who have tons of extracurricular activities, are trying to live by New York City. So how come somebody who is now income middle class, but living in a rent regulated apartment for maybe $1,500, it's gonna say, hey, I'm gonna move now to this apartment, which is $3,000. It's not gonna make sense. So I just wanna hear your views on those, you know, middle class and so-called affordable apartments.
So let me just say, with respect to NYCHA, I've been working with a group of men and women of faith in East New York. It's called Metro IAF. We had a rally 2 days ago to build 15,000 units of affordable housing, senior housing, excuse me, on NYCHA land. There are opportunities for development on NYCHA property, but in order to do it, you need authentic and you need honest brokers. And so we have, in East New York, Reverend Brawley of St. Paul's Community Baptist Church has already built senior housing. Residents support it. The residents came out to rally the other day. 1,000 residents of public housing to say, we support these men and women of faith. We support these elected officials who are behind it. We need buy-in from the federal government. We're trying to get a meeting with Mr. Carson. We received a commitment from the Speaker, Corey Johnson, and we need approval from the mayor, and we are yet to get there. My point to you is that they are, again, a crisis. Turn a crisis into an opportunity. But you can only do it with honest brokers. You can only do it with authentic voices. And you can only do it with residents around the table. And two, I support Mitchell-Lama. We need to build over rail yards, which are state-owned. Mm-hmm. We need to build, there's a number of state-owned property, but we need better coordination with our state and with our city. And again, we need cooperation with the federal government going forward. And hopefully going forward, when we have a new mayor who has vision and who recognizes that we obviously need to build in the city of New York. I'm not saying anything, guys. I'm just saying.
We only have one minute left. Maybe you have time for one quick question. Gentlemen, with the facial hair. No, I understand.
So I just want to thank this panel here. So full disclosure, so I was a planner at the Department of City Planning for 10 years. Mm-hmm. I became the district manager in Bronx Community Board 4, so we just recently passed the Jerome Avenue rezoning.
Yes.
So what I will say to you guys is, for community boards, we absolutely need your support.
Yeah.
We need resources. I have two people in my office.
That's right.
When the environmental review document landed at my desk, over 1,000 pages.
That's right.
I assigned things to my board members. If I didn't have that expertise, neither boards 4 or 5 really wouldn't be able to wade through that. So we need planning services. We need people to help us with that data, because these are going to keep coming to boards
that
we all have the same resources. I don't have GIS on my computer. I don't have Adobe Pro. If I want that, I have to pay for it out of
all the Manhattan boards have it.
Really? Mm. All right, so I got to talk to my borough president.
Yeah, so, but again, it goes to the argument, you know, we are glad that Manhattan Borough President has put this forth, but what about the other four boroughs? It's just not fair. We need to centralize this system, uniform this system. We can do it through this charter revision, or we can do it through legislation. It's so critically important. And last but not least, when we reform the EULR process, we need to look at displacement. And that's not an issue that we look at, and that's part of looking at data.
Thank you. Thank
you. And a planner.
They did have a planner.
Thank you all so much. I appreciate it.
Good job, Mitch.